For decades, Hugh McKay's job was to examine how we thought, how we lived, and collectively, what made us as a nation. He's the founder of the long-running social research project, the McKay Report. But now, he's turned inwards to explore our own understanding of ourselves. His new book is called The Inner Self, The Joy of Discovering Who We Really Are. And he says that has implications for the well-being of our whole society. What about you? Have you ever tried to get to the bottom of how you perceive yourself? Hugh says we sometimes hide from ourselves in things like busyness or perfectionism or addiction, among other things. It can be hard to be really straight with yourself. How have you found it? Tell us about it on our Facebook page. There are some really lovely, generous stories there of people's explorations into this mystery of the self. Hugh McKay, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Hilary. Good morning.
Now, when you talk about the inner self, do you just mean the relaxed private self that we might keep a bit separate from work colleagues or acquaintances, or do you mean some aspect of our personalities that might not even be fully clear to us?
Well, a bit of both, really. I think when we talk about the self, there's really an outer self and an inner self. Most of us, particularly, I guess, in the first half of our lives, when we're kind of creating our place in the world, we think of personal identity as who we are. But personal identity, of course, is really about how other people see us and how people distinguish between us and other people. I mean, identity is all about identify. It's all about difference. But at some point in our lives, sometimes triggered by turning 40 or 50 or the birth of the first child or a retrenchment or a pandemic or some other thing, causes us to think, now hang on, that isn't the whole me. There's a me inside that isn't the same as the one I present to the world. Now that sometimes means there are dark places, there are things about myself that I don't like admitting to myself. But when we go deeply inside, as you suggested a moment ago, the deeper we go, and this sounds like a bit of a paradox, the deeper we go, the less unique we turn out to be as individuals, because what we get to when we get to the core of our being is something that we share with everyone else. And that is, because we're human beings, our species requires us to act compassionately, kindly, lovingly, inclusively, tolerantly towards each other, because that's how human families, neighborhoods, groups, workplaces, organizations, that's how they survive and thrive and prosper, by cooperation, an underlying compassion.
And now, yet there are so many instances that we can look around us and see where that doesn't happen. I read someone saying once that individuals prosper when they're not moral. The collective prospers when we are moral, but individuals do better when we're not. So how do we deal with that tension?
Yeah, and it depends what you mean by do better. I mean, a person who is ferociously ambitious and competitive and self-centered might satisfy some of those ambitions that they have and feel as though they've done better, they've got richer, they got the job they wanted, etc. But that's very unlikely to have produced any deep life satisfaction. But it is true, of course, that when you think about our compassionate nature as human beings, that's a very demanding thing. I mean, it's no wonder we do hide from it sometimes. Who wants to be loving and kind and tolerant, especially towards people we don't like much? Who wants to be a good neighbor to someone who's a bit eccentric or a bit unpleasant? And yet, that is how human societies flourish. So I think the real tension, the thing I've tried to bring out in the book, is the tension between the gradual dawning as we grow, as we move, particularly through our middle years. It's often what the midlife crisis is about, the gradual dawning that when I'm being absolutely true to myself, I'm a ball of love. I'm a compassionate being. And that's demanding. I don't always want to act well. I don't always want to be loving. And so we found, as you mentioned earlier, we found all these places where we can hide. We can hide in our ambition. We can hide in our busyness. What a great hiding place busyness is. You know, I'm so busy, I don't have time for other people, let alone time for myself. One of our favorite hiding places is projection, where we project our own sense of our own frailties and flaws onto other people and criticize them for the things that are actually problems for us that we're trying to deny. So we're professional hiders, most of us, and it's not surprising. But I use the word joy in the subtitle, the joy of discovering who we really are. I think it is a joyful experience, a liberating experience to come out of hiding and say, well, yeah, there are things about me that aren't very nice, but they are part of me. But the deepest truth about me is a really nice truth.
I mean, it was interesting to see, Hugh, that the end point might be joyful, but the process is quite confronting. And you tried this as an experiment on yourself. What happens when I strip away the roles of who I am, who I play in my life? Where did you get to when you stopped thinking of yourself as in relation to other people?
Yeah, well, and of course we do that. Who am I? Oh, well, I'm a husband, I'm a father, I'm a brother, I'm a son, I'm a neighbor, I sing in a choir, I write books. All of that is stuff that I do. It's not the absolutely essential me. My gender isn't the essential me. My religious beliefs or my political convictions, these are not the essential me. When we get right down to it, we do discover that the being that I am is indivisibly connected with everyone else. And that's a kind of, it sounds like a contradiction, although I must say a pandemic is a good time to reflect on this. There's nothing like a pandemic to remind us of how interconnected we all are. But I think that's the magic, it was certainly the magic moment for me. I think it's the magic moment for any of us when in the search for who I am, I discover that the deepest truth about me is that I'm part of you and we're all part of each other. We are a species, indivisibly.
You mentioned the darkness before, Hugh, and I think a lot of people would be thinking, what if I do this digging, this difficult, confronting digging, searching for that joy of knowing who I am, and I don't like me when I find me?
Yeah, and we will all experience that, Hilary. I think that's one of the difficult truths about human nature, that we're not all, you know, even when we discover the stuff I've been talking about, we're not all sweetness and light. In fact, I find a metaphor helpful. If you think of a bright light, think of the love that's within us, our capacity for compassion, etc., as being like the bright light that enlightens us and warms us and animates us and so on. But like every bright light, it casts shadows. That's why in our folklore we say there's often a fine line between love and hate. Love produces some really nasty outcomes like jealousy, violence. So that's one of the truths about us as well, that the light in us cast shadows, and those shadows are often very dark, and they also provide hiding places where we can be consumed by our jealousy or our hate or our competitiveness or our ambition or whatever it might be, in a way that excludes us from having to exercise compassion.
And Hugh, you've got a really interesting argument about how discovering our inner selves on an individual level can have implications more broadly for the way compassion is enacted on a bigger stage. Tell us how you make that link. Is it just the cumulative effect of lots of people reaching out that compassion from inside them, or is something different going on there?
No, I think it's mainly about example and influence. I'm a great believer in the fact that the ripples of kindness keep on. That when we behave compassionately towards someone, that is such a therapeutic experience for them and for us, that it's kind of contagious. And I think it is the case. There's someone in your office, someone in your family, someone in your neighborhood who we see as a shining example of kindness and tolerance and so on. By the way, I think it's important when we're talking about this to note that compassion is not like affection. We don't have to like the people that we show compassion to. That's the greatest of all the human challenges, really, isn't it? And that's the example that really catches fire. When you see someone who's behaving compassionately, behaving kindly, supportively towards someone they don't actually like or don't even know, or who they disagree with violently about politics, and they can have a robust argument and yet be compassionate.
And this is a really interesting time, as you said, Hugh McKay, for thinking about those things, isn't it? What have been your observations in a time of pandemic on a national stage about how we've dealt with that issue of compassion and reaching out to people and supporting people across the divides?
It's just a lucky accident that the book was ready to come out at the time of the pandemic. But I think what we've witnessed in Australia, not in all countries around the world, but I think we can take a little bit of pride in this as Australians. I think what we've witnessed has been an extraordinary outpouring of compassion in local neighbourhoods, where people have sometimes discovered neighbours for the first time, or focused on the fact that that lady who lives at the end of the street, she's socially isolated all the time. I've just had a little taste of it. I'd better be a bit more attentive. I'd better stop and say good day to her. People keeping more closely in touch, whether by phone or email or Zoom or FaceTime or whatever, with friends and neighbours. Emails having a kinder tone, as people say, are you okay? Are you staying safe, etc.? I think as crises and catastrophes often do, this reminds us of who we really are and how a society can best function. So it's awful. It's awful, particularly in Victoria at the moment, most especially in Melbourne. A lot of people are very sick. People are dying. It's a tragedy on a large scale. And it's also a huge corrective, which I think has reminded us what our values are, what really matters, what our priorities should be. And in particular, has reminded us that we are citizens, we are neighbours, and that means often we have to put the common good ahead of our own personal ambition or our own personal desires.
And as you say, the tragedy is packaged up in daily numbers in Victoria. The toll has been released for today, 331 new cases in the last 24 hours and another 19 deaths. We're peaking at new records every day. But Hugh McKay, you write in your book about the pursuit of happiness and that being one of the places that we hide in from our true selves and from the work needed to find them. In a time like this, when we are daily looking at a death toll and daily feeling for other people in very difficult situations, does the pursuit of happiness come to have a different inflection? Are you seeing that?
Yes. I think we realise at times like this that what we normally think of as happiness is a very ephemeral thing and not actually worth pursuing if we're thinking of it as a sort of pleasure-induced emotional state. I mean, happiness has never been a suitable goal for life. It's a happy accident that occurs sometimes, but it has almost nothing to do with life's deepest satisfactions. And we know, I mean, our folklore has told us, even if we didn't consult the ancient philosophers, that we grow through pain, that it's often loss, it's often crisis, it's often disappointment that has much more to teach us than the bright, shiny moments in life, which are, of course, hugely enjoyable, but very fleeting and leave very little residual effect. And I think at a time like this, yes, anyone who said, well, forget all this, I'm intent on the pursuit of happiness, we'd say, well, sorry, you're not one of us. You haven't understood what's going on. There is more to life than that. A very eminent positive psychologist now at the University of Queensland, Roy Baumeister, has written that happiness is generally about taking, whereas real life satisfaction is generally about giving. And I think that's a lesson that we're learning, particularly at a moment like this, when apart from the health a crisis that we're in. We are, of course, also in an economic crisis with huge numbers of Australians, especially young Australians, unemployed, where the whole idea of happiness, theirs or ours, is kind of irrelevant. There's much more to dealing with life's realities than extracting as much happiness as we can from it.
Though I do wonder sometimes if we're looking at taking the time to look down into our inner selves and analysing who we are and thinking deeply about that, is that a bit of a luxury? I mean, if you're in an economic crisis, you've lost your job, you're really struggling just to put food on the table, is that something you have the capacity to do?
I think many people do, Hilary. In fact, one of the things that I'm struck by, and people that I've been talking to and receiving emails from and other messages over these last few months, is the extent to which people are driven by the shock, by the hardship, by the social isolation, etc., to look inwards and say, well, it really does make you think about what really matters in your life. I'm reminded, I mean, through the years of my research, I often spoke to older people who had been young adults or in their middle years in the Great Depression. And they look back on that, a period of prolonged hardship and deprivation, not life-threatening, but very, very tough. They typically look back on that with gratitude and said, was no fun while we were living through it, but the lessons that it taught us were really important lessons, which we've never forgotten. And I think we're going to see a kind of COVID generation of young Australia, the so-called millennials of today, from their age currently, from their late 20s to early 40s, who are going to be really marked by this experience in a good way.
Certainly what came before now starts to look really, really good in those rose-coloured glasses, though I have been warned against nostalgia by another chapter in your book, The Inner Self, Hugh McKay. And you write that you personally had to confront some of the mysteries and maybe self-delusions of Hugh McKay in relationships and friendships and work when you were writing this book and going through this process yourself. What did you conclude? Did you feel you managed to get to the true you?
Yeah, there were some dark aspects of that, Hilary. I think when any of us look back, once we're past middle age, and I'm way past middle age, inevitably when you look back, there are things about relationships in particular that are a mystery. How did I do so badly at two marriages that they ended? How is it that some friendships prosper and others wither? How did I let my work consume me to the extent that sometimes my family suffered from my absence because I was working long hours and traveling a lot and so on? I look back on that and say my priorities were sometimes out of kilter with my values. I think most of us would have to admit that as we get older, but it's never too late to bring them back into alignment, never too late to realise that who I really am is not that busy person, is not that person who pretended to be smarter than he was. And when we start to relax into who we really are, I think the appropriate word is liberation. It's enormously liberating to say, actually, I'm prepared to face who I am and let other people catch a glimpse of the real me.
That is very heartening. Never too late to be free. Hugh McKay, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us on Life Matters today.
Great pleasure. Thanks very much, Hilary.